This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3894, for Thursday, the 6th of July, 2023. Today's show is entitled, The Page 42 Show Ugly News Week Shows Epic. It is the first show by new host Gage Hopper, and is about 38 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is, an hour of news and commentary of software development and the overall FOSS space.
Hello, and welcome to my HPR show. The title of this show is Page 42, and it will also be available after it's broadcast on HPR, eventually on its own website. My name is Gage Hopper. I am a, well, no sense of the words, minus black hat, a hacker, but I primarily like to program. I'm more or less a software engineer without the degree. I have been wanting to do something like this for a very long time. I initially had the concept for this a while ago, and I wanted to have co-hosts, and that did not work out. It's been a couple years, but I'm here. I didn't just find out about HPR, but I didn't really understand it as a concept until maybe about a week ago at Southeast Linux Fest, where Mordency explained it to me. I'm a one of the revolving contributors of the Linux Lugcast, and now I'm here on HPR. So, plans for page 42. Just a little bit of housekeeping here. I intend to set up a Limi and a Matrix for it, as well as a Castapod for archiving previous shows. Again, my name is Gage Hopper. I started with computers when I was about 6. My uncle built the first computer that I ever used, and the computer that I'm using right now to record this was built by myself. I'm a little bit proud of that fact. But today, this is more of like a proto show. I don't have how I'm going to do this going forward completely planned out, but I plan to put out something about an hour long each week starting from here. So I'm going to get into our news topics for this week. I have some other plans other than news to do, but we'll get to that in a bit. So starting with the news, Rust being destroyed by foundation idiocy. As I put in my show notes, there's really no way to be nice about this. I think the YouTube video that I linked to, Let's Get Rusty's commentary on this is a really, really, really good source. When I found out about their keynote speaker being dropped by the foundation, I just gotta be honest, my mind was blown. Like, this is the second time, in the last 3 or 4 months that something this stupid has come out about the Rust Foundation. At this point, I don't know if Rust, as in the project, needs the foundation, because at this point, it's a hindrance. I understand wanting to protect your IPs and stuff, but they're doing it wrong, and the community sees this. It's embarrassing. Like, there are people who have spent years trying to get jobs with, by learning Rust, by going through and actually learning this somewhat steep learning curve of a programming language, and to sit here and say that, you know, stuff like, oh, we have the Rust trademark. Well, you can't use the word Rust in your project's name, or alternatively, you can't use this version of the spelling of the word Rust in your project's name, in your project's marketing materials. If you go to a conference and speak, you can't use it there because it's our trademark. At least that's my understanding of the document that they put out. Now, to be fair, both times, the Rust project leadership has come out and tried to get in front of this, but the fact that Jean Hyde, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but the fact that he was offered an invitation as a keynote speaker and then just all of a sudden out and decided to, or not him, but the Rust Foundation just all out and decided to be like, yeah, no, we know we sent you a keynote invitation, but you're not a keynote speaker at RustConf. Like, what? How are you going to tell someone they're a keynote speaker and then turn around and then be like, oh yeah, this is just a regular presentation? Like, bro, that's not how this shit works. It's just not. I'm kind of sad because I really, really like Rust as a language. I've defended it pretty harshly in the past. I think it's not really good after Mitchell Baker effectively fired the people working on Rust, the people working on Servo, you know, all that stuff several years ago. I don't think it's good for this project's main sponsor to drop it and then turn around, start fresh, and have problems like this. Like, it's just, it's not a good look. It doesn't bode well for the future. The fact that there's been two of these incidents now leads me to believe that unless there's some new leadership installed at the top of the Rust Foundation, I genuinely don't believe that problems like this are going to stop. If anyone from the Rust Foundation or anyone in leadership at the Rust Project is listening to this, there's some people at the top that gotta go. They gotta go. All right. Moving on. See here from Beta News. Opera One AI powered browsing tab lands in Windows, Linux. Link here is actually for all three, but the headliner here is Linux, because since when is Linux first class for anything anymore? Well, I guess you could say ever. We still have GIMP because they won't put Photoshop on Linux. If that tells you anything, it's 2023. That's neither here nor there. You could get into an entire free software debate on that. I'm not going to. But Opera introduces the first browser with its own proper AI, if you don't include Cortana. The AI's name is Aria, and it's linked to OpenAI's ChatGPT. And according to my notes here, an interesting consequence of this is that Aria knows Opera's knowledge base really well, as it's been fed the entire knowledge base. So I find this not necessarily surprising that the Opera team brought this over. I think one of the only mainstream things that Linux has consistently gotten since I started dailying it in 2015 has been a browser. And it's been all the browsers. I mean, even Microsoft Edge is on Linux. You might not like it, but it's here. I personally use Brave. And we're going to get into that here in a second. This AI is based on ChatGPT. And so, I mean, ChatGPT has been in the news for a lot of stuff. The most recent thing I've seen from it up until now was actually a professor who had the brilliant idea to basically can half his class, because he ran all of their essays through apparently OpenAI has a tool, if I could talk today. OpenAI has a tool that will allegedly let you run an essay through it, and it will tell you the likelihood or something to that effect that it was generated by ChatGPT. The fact that they even tried to invent a tool like this is funny. It's kind of a circus show to me. I believe that ChatGPT doesn't always pass the Turing test, but in the case of being fed a trove of information and then being asked to write a cohesive essay on the topic, it passes the Turing test, right? You cannot, And I know this because I've done it. Specifically for Rust, by the way. Rust was when back in January, December, when I first got on OpenAI and went in there and actually fooled around with it back in December of last year. One of the things that I noticed was that it can really, really output documentation well. And I got it to spit some stuff out about Rust that I could not find anywhere else. It was honestly very helpful in answering questions. It was a really, really nice experience. I don't have any complaints, but these professors do. And so circling back to the topic of, you know, college essays, this guy really tried to can half his entire class because this tool put out by OpenAI decided to tell him that, you know, half those essays were generated by ChatGPT. There was a lot of cussing. He had like arrogant emails that he sent out to students. I personally believe that even if he was tenured, they should have let him go. But also, I have a track record of being very against university, and so this is not too shocking that this happened. But I mean, when your entire curriculum is here, read chapters 4, 5, and 7 out of a textbook, then write a fucking essay about it, which I've been to college twice. This is how it works. They don't have anything original to have you do, so they just tell you to write essays. And now that a tool has come out that passes the Turing test to be able to write an essay like a human, given the same information that a human would have access to on the internet, I think it's time to get good, bro. As the kids would say, get good. Universities, you gotta up your game. You've been doing the same lazy shit for how long now? Longer than I've been alive, that's for damn sure. But circling back to Opera's use of ChatGPT, this requires an Opera account to use. I find it unfortunate that it is GPT based. I really wish it had been something simpler, something that runs locally. I'm not going to use it. I use Brave. Eventually I'm going to start using Tor because I want to experiment with it. And, having a browser that is going to send every single thing that I do back to potentially somewhere like OpenAI or Opera's servers or really anywhere else. I don't want that in my browser. Okay. Moving on. Oh, this is a fun one. Amazon retaliates against Lewis. So, while I was at Self, a very interesting event occurred. Of course, none of us were paying attention to the news cycle because we were all at this insanely awesome Linux event. Seriously, I had a great time. I will definitely be grabbing a plane ticket out there next year. But Lewis Rossman, he is a YouTuber, and before he was a YouTuber, he ran and still continues to run Rossman Repair Group. He employs about 7 people, if I remember correctly, to, you know, repair iPhones, Macs, all types of things. But Lewis is a very prominent figure in the right to repair community. I'm sure most people listening to Hacker Public Radio are aware of his existence, but I needed to explain this so that just in case anyone else listening doesn't know who he is, dude's a legend. But the week that I went to Self, the week that Self happened, sometime during that time, a software engineer at Microsoft got locked out of all of his Amazon stuff, his entire smart home, all the shit that he, you know, bought with his own money as a legal adult in the United States, as a homeowner, presumably, in the United States. On the one hand, there's a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, man, I said from the start, don't use these smart devices. But as he explained in his comment, you know, he would be bringing his work home with him, right? He's already a software engineer at Microsoft. He doesn't want to do all the deployment stuff, you know, that would be required to go and actually set something like that up. You know, for a lot of us, it's fun, but I would also probably not have the motivation to do stuff like that, or Home Assistant, or what was before Home Assistant? There was another project that my understanding is that they ran out of funding, like Meebo or something. I don't quite remember. But basically, the gist is that consumer bought these products, and because of the consumer saying something that the company that made the products didn't like, he was basically gated out of his own home, right? He talked about how he couldn't use any of his Echo devices, he couldn't use any of his cameras or any of the shit that he had connected to Amazon services at the time. Now, let's get into why this guy, this Microsoft engineer, had all his stuff locked out. So, what had happened was, cannot believe this. He had I don't remember the exact brand name, I think it was like Eufy or something. Equivalent of a Ring doorbell. It wasn't a Ring doorbell, but it was, you know, the sort of generic equivalent of that that still hooks up to Amazon or whatever smart home system you're using, whatever ecosystem you're in. And the thing that happened was an Amazon driver came up to his door, put the package on the porch, and the Eufy doorbell said something along the lines of, thank you, have a nice day. And the guy apparently thought it was a racial slur, you know, despite the fact that it's on literally every one of these doorbells that's made. And I just get, sorry, cat's in place, cat shouldn't be. The guy thought the doorbell said something racist and reported it to Amazon. Sorry, I'm having a bit of an ADHD stroke over here. I was kind of left speechless by this, I'm not going to lie. The fact that a company can accuse you of doing something that you very, very clearly did not fucking do, and then said company will proceed to lock you out of all the smart devices that you've purchased and connected to their service infrastructure. By the way, that's what this is. This is your home's infrastructure. They've taken it down because of a false report made against you. That's what this Amazon guy, or not Amazon guy, Microsoft guy, had happened to him. And Lewis Rossman posted a video calling out Amazon on their bullshit, which is what this is, bullshit. And so I'm kind of just amazed at this, because the story keeps going, right? So Lewis had Amazon affiliate links on his website for a good amount of years. I think he said like 8 to 10 years or something like that, or 12 years or some really, really long amount of time. And Amazon sent him an email after his video went up last week or 2 weeks ago, about the Amazon driver and the Microsoft engineer. They sent him an email and basically said, yeah, you're not an affiliate anymore because you were trying to sell soldering equipment to your close friends and family, you know, because that's real likely. I think Amazon has been left unchecked on a lot of fronts for far, far too long. I think Amazon needs to be regulated and potentially broken up, and same with Google. I mean, the only time in, I don't want to say the only time in history we've seen it, but I'm the only time that I can think of off the top of my head that one of these tech companies has been broken up is still the fucking Baby Bells. And that was for a lot of listeners, probably doesn't feel like a long time ago, but I'm 25 and that all that stuff happened like over a decade before I was born. So, the videos are out there. At the very least, it is entertainment, but it's not something that I would take lightly as far as where we're headed. I don't have smart home stuff. I don't plan to have smart home stuff, I'm not going to lie. If I did, it would have to be intranet only, no internet. I don't have that level of trust, and shit like this is exactly the reason why, you know? I also want to point out Amazon never released an apology. They never admitted wrongdoing. They just no accountability. So I guess I'll leave this one off with, let's regulate Amazon. All right. Moving on down the list. Tom's Hardware. Yes. So, Mesa just got a, here it is, 23.2. 23.2 just released for Mesa. And with it comes a massive boost to Intel's Arc driver stack. I have a couple of quotes here. First quote, Intel open source Linux graphics driver engineer Francisco Jerez discussed the Intel/GFX 12.5 code change on GitLab. According to Jerez, some performance features were expected to be enabled by default, had been accidentally disabled by the kernel. Okay, so I don't have any Arc stuff. I run a media server called Pigeon Bastard, and once it's set back up because I'm rebasing on Debian from Ubuntu because I don't like the direction Canonical has taken. But the server, or the physical machine that I use as the server for Pigeon Bastard, will eventually have an Arc card in it because I want the nice AV1 encoding that comes with that. And so in order to get it, you could probably do it in software. It'd probably take an eon. But the Arc card, as of, at least from what I can tell, is, at least on launch, the only one that had hardware-level AV1 encoding. So, on to Linux gaming. I'm actually pretty curious about Arc, and I might actually pop it into my main machine, the Arc A7 whatever that I get. There's a good chance that I'm going to plug this into my main machine and run a bunch of benchmarks on it, because I really want to see how this thing handles compared to my 1060 that's aging poorly in my main rig right now. But that's neither here nor there. The next quote is, confounding code detectives, the compressible partial write merge enable, coherent partial write merge enable, and cross-tile partial write merge enable bits all appeared to be enabled when a query was run on an idle system. Nevertheless, these L3 partial write merging features were getting clobbered during 3D context initialization by an i915 workaround and causing a serious performance bottleneck. And the last quote from this is, it is expected that the Mesa 23.2 code improvements will get to stable Linux OS distros sometime around late August or September. First thing to note here, I've never heard of an i915 architecture before. I didn't know they were still making those. Like the iXXX whatever for different x86 variants. I guess that just shows how much I know. But the fact that they were able to find this with the amount of sleuthing they had to do is actually pretty impressive. A lot of this stuff is over my head. I know just enough to understand the gist of it, which is these were, okay, so we have performance stuff. Okay, we know we have performance stuff. It's been disabled inside the kernel. We didn't know it was disabled by the kernel. So now we're enabling it and pushing that out in the next release. The gist, you know? So that is happening. I really, really, really cannot wait to benchmark an Arch card. I am very, very ready for that. It's a project that I want to do. I want to, you know, run some virtualization on there as well. See, you know, how well it works compared to both my 1060. I believe somewhere down here I also have an RX 580, but don't quote me on that. But that's it for Intel Arc news, I guess. And I'm actually going to skip around in the show notes here. Next source is from Hackaday. I actually really like Hackaday as a source. Hackaday is entertaining sometimes. So is the register. I don't have any register sources on here. But, so, I just gotta say, what the hell, Red Hat. Red Hat acquired CentOS back in 2014. CentOS Stream was announced in 2020. And as of this week, RHEL packages are no longer published to the CentOS Git repo. This is not news that I'm particularly happy about, because I was already planning on getting off of Red Hat for the machines that I still have on it. I'm not currently using RHEL, but I am using an instance of Rocky somewhere. I gotta be honest, for me personally, all my server stuff, all of my projects are probably going to be switching to Debian. And I mean just like straight up Debian. For all of its drawbacks and its flaws, mainline Debian is not plagued with the issues that some of these enterprise companies like Canonical and Red Hat are. But something that I read in this article that I did not read in other articles was the commentary on the GPL. And I know a lot of people are talking about it, but up until I read this article, a lot of other articles are saying, oh, well, because, you know, the source code is being distributed to people who pay for the commercial software, it should be fine. This article actually kind of disputes that, which I find interesting. It's definitely worth a read. I believe that that the article said it was section 6 in the GPL. I would have to go back and reread that paragraph, but Red Hat potentially violated the GPL, and if it's found that they did, I think IBM deserves to be sued into oblivion. But I mean, at the very least, if it's not a direct violation, it is a spiritual violation. It goes against the spirit of GPL code, which is pretty unfortunate. I've been disappointed in Red Hat for the last 6 months, according to my show notes. That is true. So I met Ben Cotton at Ohio Linux Fest back last year, last December, like the first week of last December. I had never been to a Linux Fest before up until then. I mean, Ben was really nice to me. I think I stood at his table. He was doing a book signing, and I had to have stood at his table for at least an hour and a half. The guy was really, really nice to me. He, you know, he kind of dove into CoreOS as like a concept. And I actually did check it back out when I got back, about maybe 2 or 3 weeks before they laid him off. But Ben Cotton is no longer with Red Hat. He was doing a lot of work over there, if I remember correctly. The firing of Ben Cotton was the first in a list of things that really kind of irked me all at the same time. I mean, we can get into Kickstart versus Ignition. Red Hat doesn't seem to have a cohesive strategy for its tooling when it comes to immutable distributions. I mean, you've got regular Fedora using this thing called Kickstart. You've got CoreOS using another thing called Ignition. Now, I am of the belief that Ignition is the future. They need to put Ignition in mainline Fedora. Or if it's not ready, they need to get it ready and put it in Fedora. The fact that there's two different systems for Silverblue versus CoreOS, or the Silverblue-like ones like Kinoite and all those, I don't know. I gave up dealing with CoreOS server-side. It was a real PITA to try to set up. I was really hoping that wouldn't be the outcome. I really wanted it to work because the allure of reproducible Linux installs is pretty great from an IT perspective at the very least. And I know Nix exists. I could go get the minimal image and try it again. I have not had the greatest success with Nix, so I just, I don't bother with it. I followed the instructions on their website to a T on my laptop when I first got it. I booted up a live image of Fedora, tried to install it to a brand new hard drive, brand new NVMe SSD, came with my laptop, right? And Nix just completely fails. Something about a file store in Etsy or a Nix store in Etsy not being there after it spent 25 minutes putting stuff in said Etsy directory, you know, just stuff that should not happen on a properly functioning distribution. Unfortunate, but it is what it is. But back to Red Hat / Fedora. I really am not a fan of the direction that Red Hat has been headed the past maybe half a year. They're still not as bad as Canonical, in my opinion, but they are definitely starting to climb that rope. I hope that they stop. But, I mean, between the media codec firestorm that they were having, to GPL violations, to screwing over downstream communities like Alma and Rocky, just all this stuff that I've talked about, it's just, dude, things did not used to be like this. What happened? Well, you got bought out by IBM. IBM's running Red Hat into the ground. That's, I also think it's important to note that Silverblue and CoreOS were at one point both under the same Project Atomic banner. They're both cut from the same cloth, is what I'm trying to say. So the fact that they have two different configuration systems for installation is ridiculous. And a bunch of probably duplicated work from the engineering side of things, right? Like, it's not a good look. The notes here also want me to mention the media server again. I know I said it before, but it will be Debian because of this. I just don't trust Red Hat for any serious projects. I might still use Fedora for workstation purposes, but even then, like, my laptop's running POP. My main desktop is pending a move to Debian or something to that effect, or POP. I don't know, just really not fun news. But I really think the past week and a half has had some news coming out in the FOSS space that is very I don't like fear-mongering, I don't like saying concerning, but it is concerning. It's just pointing out concerning trends in the industry. The whole Red Hat, if I could talk, the whole Red Hat thing is really, really something that hurts to see. They were built as a Linux juggernaut, and so as somebody who loves Linux and wants to see it thrive, it's very, very disheartening for me to see Red Hat take this sort of insolent path, I guess, for lack of a better word. What time am I at? Oh, dude, it's a full episode. I actually didn't think I'd get this much out of five news articles, but here we are. If I could get rid of the ums and all the other nonsense that is, you know, part of my daily speech, if I could articulate my thoughts a little bit better, I might be a little bit better at podcasting and stuff like this. But I also want to say that this is obviously the first show. I'll probably get better at this as it goes on. The last thing. So, this is not really a news article, but it is something a little bit different that I want to do. I don't know if it's going to happen, but as of recently, despite being in the wake of Rust and all that stuff, I'm actually working on a series of portfolio projects to get myself either a DevOps or some sort of low-tier software engineering gig. I really want to prove myself in the field. I really am passionate about software engineering and computer science. My main website is madcompscientist.com. It's where effectively all of my documentation for the portfolio project is going. But I would like to introduce Kotlin Corner here as a segment on the show. It's not, there's nothing here yet, but it's something I'd really like to do, something I'm really interested in doing. you know, I don't like the doom and gloom news headlines like today, but it just is what it is. As I start to diversify what content I put up here on page 42 in Hacker Public Radio, I'd like to see this show take a bit of a creative direction compared to previous endeavors of my own. But I would like to cover, you know, when I discover concepts that are really unique or interesting in Kotlin, when I put interesting things together that I wouldn't have thought otherwise with Kotlin, I'd really like to showcase this here. I learned Ruby a couple years ago after working with C for so long. I kind of looked at programming differently after that, and I kind of hope that this is the same kind of experience for me, learning a new language. It might not be. I don't think Kotlin's going to be as easy as Ruby was to pick up, but you never know. And I say this not because Kotlin's a hard language to learn. I say this because the JVM web frameworks don't wipe your butt for you like Rails does. I think Rails was a very of its time thing. And I know a lot of people say that. I like the simplicity of it. I also am of the understanding that at a certain point that simplicity comes back to bite you in the rear. And so that, I mean, yeah. So Kotlin, I think it's a really, really cool language. I think JetBrains is a cool company. I don't terribly care for Java itself, but Kotlin is, like, as a concept, interesting to me, partially because it has turned itself from just, like, what you would normally associate, you know, like a programming language with, you know, like, how most programming languages drag the kitchen sink with them. Kotlin doesn't do that. It's effectively a language front end, if anything, because not only is it a JVM language, but it's an LLVM language. It can be transpiled to JavaScript. It can be transpiled to TypeScript. It can be transpiled to literally anything at this point. And they market it this way, which is what I find really, really awesome about it. A lot of languages, even if they do stuff like this, they don't advertise it as much. But that's just my two cents. We have gone on almost 45 minutes at this point. I would prefer it to be a bit longer, but this is the first episode, so I'll cut myself some slack. Any feedback? I can be found on Twitter at... Ooh, what am I on? Hold on, let's go on an adventure here. I don't have a Mastodon. I won't be creating one of those until I have an Insta myself. But I am at Hopper_MCS on Twitter. That's DM me, at me. I don't care. I'll try to respond. But other than that, I hope you guys enjoyed. And I will see you in the next one.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.